Should Corvette be a brand of its own? Could GM have had a different CEO? And more than half a century of building race engines for Ford.
Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone. Your journey, our passion.
This is Auto Line After Hours with John McElroy, episode 180 for January 25, 2013. From Indy to Le Mans, Mose knows engines. Watch Autoline After Hours live at autoline.tv every Thursday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time or 2300 GMT. You can subscribe to this podcast for free by searching for Autoline in iTunes, Stitcher, or by following the links on our website. So, Peter DeLorenzo.
John McElroy, how are you?
I'm doing well, man, but I can't wait to get into talking about the Corvette stuff here because I think you stirred up a hornet's nest with your ideas.
Yes, the Corvette faithful have their pitchforks out for me.
Well, which Corvette faithful? Faithful, because there are multiple Corvette faithfuls. There really are. And it's astonishing how diverse the population is.
And that, folks, is the voice of Jim Hall from 2953
Analytics.
The man who knew too much.
And still does.
Yes.
Even though he might be forgetting some.
Where am I?
So let's go back to talking about Peter's idea of breaking Corvette off from Chevrolet and let it being its own standalone brand. First off, I want to ask you, you've been talking about this for a while. I mean, this goes back a couple of years, but now you finally put it in writing, really formulated it. What got you to that point?
Well, I just, this is, as Mark Royce reminded me, this is a different company. And I think, he thinks I dwell on GM's past too much. That might be true, but they're finding new roads now, don't you know? but it is a new company. It's a different company. And after Dan Akerson moves on, it'll be even more different. You know, they have two global brands. They have Chevrolet and they have Cadillac. One of the marketing guys said what was the plumber comment? Do you remember that during the show, Jim?
No, I didn't hear a plumber comment.
Yeah, he said we...
Oh, yeah. I missed that. Corvettes for successful plumbers.
And we want to change that. That was Mr. Perry who said that. Wrangling Corvette's image is something that I don't think GM's done a very good job at.
A friend of mine... reminded me, actually it was you also that reminded me, that the last time they did a Corvette commercial before the bout with the ZR1 and so on was 1984.
No, there was another one.
There was an in-between one?
Yeah, there was the one where the kid was fantasizing flying in the Corvette in the city.
Yes.
And they made him pull it off the air, and I thought it was fantastic.
C6.
Yeah.
Yep. Yeah, so, but the thing is, it wasn't a standalone Corvette commercial. Wasn't that also with that transporter with all the other Chevys in it, too?
Yeah, but the most famous one was...
The flying car. It was too dangerous.
Well, yeah, but the one you speak about in 84 was the little kid... Dreaming, he sees the Corvette and he envisions himself in it. That was with the Heartbeat of America.
Yeah.
But anyway, getting back to the image thing, and I pointed this out, of late, GM has done a much better job with getting the Corvette image out there. But, throughout their illustrious record at Le Mans, it was always like pulling teeth to get them. First you'd see a bottom thing in the USA Today, and then they'd do a page ad. But, this car.
But that's the thing about it. It's for the longest time. I mean, I remember when somebody from Chevrolet, when I was working there, said, we have to protect the Corvette's image. And it's wrong. You've got an image car that you're not leveraging to use for its image enhancement. Why do you even have it?
Well, yeah, it's, as I pointed out, any other car company, if they had the Corvette, would use it as the tip of their technological spear. And if a Corvette wins Le Mans, I mean, yes, I know it's old media. Of course, you'd do the social aspect, but there should be double truck spreads in Wall Street Journal, USA Today, New York Times, West Coast papers. This is a big deal. Mm-hmm. And I think for too long, not all. I mean, the true believers who work on Corvette get it. and certain people in the upper echelons.
The car couldn't have survived in the organization if nobody got it.
No, the true believers saved the car.
Right, over and over and over again. Right.
And they're still doing it today.
Right.
And, you know, as I pointed out, yes, it's the best Corvette ever to drive, I'm sure. And I, you know, they did a fabulous job, and we'll get to the design in a minute. But the image of the Corvette, it's been underutilized. And, you know, this is a car to take pride in. I mean, it's a tremendous car. It's achieved great success on the racetrack. But it's always getting caught up to me in this Chevrolet. And, you know, it used to be, yeah, it's the essence of the business. Well, there's a little bit of Chevrolet in every Cavalier or whatever it is.
Right.
You know, you get the parents that come in to look at the Corvette in the showroom. And they buy a Sonic.
But I know where you're getting at.
But that's leveraging an image. If you want to have an image builder, you have to use it. No. Somebody who's no longer with the organization in marketing once told me, we really need the Camaro, Jim, because we need an image card Chevy. And I'm thinking, this guy says this, and it's like, wait a minute. You've got the Corvette. You've had it at this time for whatever it had been, 53 years. And it's like, and you're telling me now you need another image car because you don't use the one you have?
Well, and again, don't forget that in marketing, the adage is, well, you know, Corvette sells themselves. We don't have to really.
Right. But I think what you're also getting at here is what everybody has always said of the Corvette is it's a really good car for the money.
Yeah,
and there's always that rejoinder for the money because it's got to be a Chevrolet. So no one's ever really thought that it stood toe to toe from a brand image standpoint.
Oh, well, it doesn't from a brand image standpoint.
Because, but it shouldn't have to.
Well, but it could.
And that's what this discussion is about.
That's why I proposed three Corvettes. I proposed a lower price car, kind of not bare bones, but only
the attainable. Aspirational car.
Yeah, base of $39,995.
I think Ben's got a picture of that one, yeah.
Yeah, Roadster Josiah LaCola did those for me in 48 hours.
Mm-hmm. So this is where I first started. You know, what got, obviously you were planning on coming out with this this piece on Autoline Daily on your website talking all about it. How did you get this guy to do these drawings? And I didn't know the turnaround was that.
Well, the famed designer who worked at GM Design on the CTS Coupe, he led the team, you know him, who also helps at College for Creative Studies now, John Manoogian. Mm-hmm. I ran into him on the show floor, and then I emailed him. I said, you know, I've got this idea. Do you know anyone who'd be interested in doing it? I mean, for the exposure. Mm-hmm. And he didn't hesitate. He said, get with Josiah. And I did. And he was enthused. And I thought he did a great job. And,
right.
You know, so it's a three-step Corvette. There's the standard Stingray, which is an open car, maybe about the size of a Boxster, but maybe a little smaller, light. Twin turbo V6 with 375 horsepower and a target weight of 2,800 pounds. But obviously, we were talking, I would love a little jewel-like all-new aluminum V8, you know.
Normally aspirated.
Yeah. That would be very cool. But the price point would be $39,995, and the options would be limited so that you could get everything on it and drive it out of the showroom for just under $50,000. Then the new car would become the Corvette SS, and I would do some tweaks to it, but that's still the bread and butter Corvette. And then I would, you know, if it's a separate brand, then you're going to have a halo for the brand, and that's when I want to do the Corvette Chaparral, you know, in homage to Jim Hall with his permission.
Not this Jim Hall.
No. This Jim Hall.
Jim Man a Few Words Hall.
And there it is up on the screen. And, you know, this would be the vet that everyone has always wanted.
Supercar.
The supercar. But they could do it in, you know, in a cost-effective way. And, you know, take a page from the Ford GT and only build, like, 1,000 of them over.
So you have lower cost tooling. You're set up for low production, of course. You know, and that's a logical way to build any car like this. When you get to a certain price point, don't tool it for $100,000. Yeah. Never mind.
So, and I love the fact that you're paying homage to Chaparral. I love resuscitating. The only thing I would add to that sketch is movable aerodynamics.
Well,
I'm not necessarily a giant wing, but Chaparral always broke all the ground on.
And, of course, this car would have that and more. And I thought of a, you know, all-wheel drive, but, you know.
Rear bias. So like an R8 in that respect.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And, you know, the LT1, maybe twin turboed or whatever, you know, just go for it. Carbon fiber chassis, all the latest stuff. Yeah, I would love movable aerodynamic devices. And put a price of like $175 and have everyone say, oh, that's, you know. But at $175.
It undercuts a $458 by how many thousand?
Yeah, but that's sort of.
That's too cheap.
Yeah, maybe it is. Maybe it's $200. But, you know, this would be GM showing every bit of technological might in that they have or that they can get their hands on.
And race it at Le Mans.
And race it for the overall win.
You know, the interesting thing about this is there's a parallel with another car company that's a very successful sports car manufacturer.
McLaren?
Mm-mm. You said it yourself. Yep. Boxster?
Yeah, Porsche.
The Stingray, the real Corvette's the 911. It's the 918.
Yeah.
But that leads to my question. Why not go after Porsche with the new Corvette brand? And why stop at sports cars? Why not do an executive sedan or saloon, as they would say? Why not do an SUV?
You've got to learn to walk. You have to make sure that this... But it's a good question that if it worked and if it was successful, could you do a car like that?
Well, think about it. You know, Porsche, up until fairly recently, only sold 100,000 cars a year globally.
Sports cars.
And I don't know what their sales numbers are up to now.
It's a lot.
I don't think they're at 200,000 yet,
very
are
close.
They? Okay, very close. But what I'm getting at is in the not-too-distant past, I mean, within the last decade, mm-hmm. Porsche was making a lot of money at only 100,000 cars a year. Corvette did, what, 25,000 sales in the U.S. market last year?
In round numbers, yeah.
In round numbers. Globally, I don't know if it...
Last
year was worse. Last year was...
14,900.
Oh, is that
Yeah, it was under 15,000 last calendar year.
In the bad old years, in the really bad days of Corvette, which was like 74 to... 79, they set some sort of sales record, but the image of the car really took a hit.
But what I'm getting at is if Porsche had a solid business case as a standalone company at 100,000 units, and Corvette, let's say, in a better year, does 25,000, what I'm getting at is give it a few more models in another decade.
25,000, by the way, with limited marketing, because Corvette is still not a global car.
Correct.
You know, there are lots of markets where you can't buy a Corvette. So, and that's the thing Porsche does have. When you've got the world open to you the way they do, it helps a lot. And that's why, this is the whole thing about General Motors and global anyway. It's the problem they've got with Cadillac. Cadillac could be a global brand, not just a Chinese and North American brand. But where are you going to sell them? You going to do it with some outside company like Kreumann's? No.
Well, at any rate, you know, is GM going to do this? No, but I would like them to really seriously entertain taking the Stingray name off the current car and put it in on this entry-level car and do a real Stingray in terms of impact visually. And I think they need the car. You know, they need the car. And maybe they discover after they did that, this is, you know, this isn't bad. You know, we've got, you know, because they, what did we hear at the auto show? Well, this C7 skews younger. It didn't skew younger to me. But if you do a Stingray that comes in it.
The way you skew younger is have a more affordable car.
Yeah. I mean, skew younger with a Stingray that's all in is $49,000.
Yeah, because Corvette now starts at $49,800, add delivery into $50,000 for just a base Corvette. Now, base Corvette's a lot nicer than some other base cars for the same money, but...
But I would, if I were them, I would, you know, seriously consider doing that. Now, the Chaparral, they should do that.
They got this close to calling a car Chaparral before.
Yeah.
Only because they didn't want to give some money to Jim Hall for it, they spelled it Chaparelle. And it was going to go on, what was the 75 Monza?
Yeah.
They had PR photos taken of the car that had a Chaparral badge on it. Chaparral. I know, it's
sad. Fortunately, that didn't happen.
Yeah.
But, Yeah, you know, if Ford demonstrated that you could do this with the Ford GT, what, they made 1,500 of them over 3 years?
Yeah, the leveraged production, though. Remember, the whole thing about that being built at Wixom was a little bit of a scam, because there was that Saleen-operated facility on Maple Road.
In Troy.
Yeah, in Troy, where they actually did the primary construction of those cars. Then they were shipped and finished.
Right.
So,
because that was a union issue.
That was
union
issue.
Would not let Ford, not let them do the final assembly.
But, you know, I look at the McLaren 12C, mm-hmm. and I don't see anything on that car that GM couldn't do. I don't see one thing.
And if GM did it, the car would at least have a little more passion than it does.
Yeah, I mean,
the car is the perfect Ron Dennis vehicle. You drive it and forget you had it 20 minutes ago.
Yeah.
And you want to be rude to everybody you talk to when you're driving.
But yeah, if it's a Corvette Chaparral.
Exactly.
And it's got that motor in the back, but yet it's got all the stuff. You know, I don't have any doubt that the true believers at GM could do a car like that. They could do it in their sleep.
Mm-hmm.
It's an intriguing idea
yeah.
Of taking a brand, you know, that's only been one model and
but
breaking it off.
Breaking Corvette away from Chevrolet. Never happened.
Well, and the thing is, your plan, the car plan you've laid out works even if it is a Chevy. You don't need to do it as a standalone to broaden the range.
Yeah.
The problem is, in a way, it's not a problem, but the challenge is that the more affordable car is going to have to be tooled in numbers that they haven't tooled Corvettes for in a long time.
Right.
And there's that question about, you know, how do you do that without going overboard and building too many? Because all of these cars, if they're proper image cars, you have to sell 50 too few. Or 1,000 too few. You're doomed the day you sell the one too many.
Right.
That's right. That's Ferrari's magic.
Absolutely.
And they learned that a long time ago.
Yeah, but they're really on the verge of losing it. Pretty soon they're going to have shopping malls named after them.
Oh, because they've extended the brand beyond any kind of logical. Yeah, yeah. This whole idea of Ferrari shoes. I'm sorry. Excuse me.
Well, I mean, the thing in Abu Dhabi and, it's...
Ferrari world.
Yeah, Ferrari world. I mean, they're right on the edge.
Hey, let's jump to another topic real quick. This story that's broken. Ed Whitaker, former CEO and chairman of General Motors, has written a book saying he wanted to choose Mark Reuss as the next CEO. And I found this so telling a comment. He said Dan Akerson wanted the job from day one, and that's how it went. And he goes on to say something that wasn't very elegant the way it came out. And I'm going, whoa, not very elegant. Well, what's this guy really think?
How long was Big Ed at GM?
Less than 2 years.
Yeah, I was going to say 18, 19 months, I think.
Right. 18
yeah.
months. And yeah. How long was he chairman right off the bat?
From the...
Yeah, he was. Right. That was his insertion into the organization, right. You know.
Well, it's an interesting book. First of all, he throws... we were just talking about Fritz under the bus completely.
Fritz Henderson, right.
I mean, just... You know,
mm-hmm.
Which I find kind of interesting because I thought Fritz was a pretty good guy. I thought Fritz had a pretty successful career at GM, largely outside of the United States.
Well, Fritz is a good guy, first of all, but
Fritz had to clean up a lot of messes.
Right.
A lot. And the truth is, that's why Fritz knew what was where. He knew where all the skeletons were. He really did. And when they were in the whole thing of turning it into two businesses, the dissolution company and the new company, Fritz had to be that guy to say, dissolution, we want this. I mean, he was the only guy that could have gotten him through that.
So I think he got a very unfair...
Wasn't he the guy who said we ought to dump Opel right now while we got the chance?
I believe that was part of it, but there was also a seesaw action going on with the dumping of Opel in that the question got raised, why didn't we just let it go? And there were some people that said, well, except that this guy thought we could make it work and this guy didn't. And so that was especially ugly.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, the big thing in the book is Mr. Ed thought that he would have put Mark Reuss into the job. And, you know, I'm sure there's a side to that say, well, he wasn't ready for it. But
and a side that says he had not enough experience. So they put in a guy with no experience.
With no experience.
So
remember, part of the thing after Ed left, part of the thing was selling the IPO to institutional investors. Seriously, that was what part of the chairman's job was going to be. He had to go and peddle that damned IPO. Now, that's something where Mark, I suspect, would not have liked it. He probably would have had a hard time shaving when he had to go talk to some of these guys. But Dapper Dan, that's what he does. I mean, I could see in that respect, he was the guy to do that part of it.
Just that part of it.
That's what I'm saying. That's the part that would crush regular human beings.
Nonetheless, I thought that
I'm still fascinated by.
There's more to the story than what has come out.
And much of it we'll never know, but we will hear some fabulous, you know, versions of what really happened, I think.
Yeah, 20 years from now.
No, I'm saying because we have the blogosphere.
Yeah.
We will hear some fabulous things about this just by reading on the interwebs.
Well, suffice to say, if Mark wasn't there, GM's product position wouldn't be nearly as good. I mean, he is the guy he's the straw that stirs the drink there in terms of products. So
agreed.
I hope he has a long tenure there.
Hey, why don't we take a quick break and bring on our guest, Mose Noland, who has got some amazing stuff to tell us about Ford racing engines. Ben, let's give a shout-out to our friends at Bridgestone.
Yeah, I'll put this down.
Now we got Mose Noland joining us on the set. Mose, it's great to have you here.
Well, thank you. Thank you for inviting me on the show.
So
my pleasure.
Mose, welcome.
Just to give people the background, you told me earlier you spent 57 years at the Ford Motor Company. I mean,
when was your first day?
October 28th, 1955.
Wow. So usually they kick you out after way before, you know, 40 years, and they kick you out of there. How'd you stay on so long?
Well, it's a funny thing, John. I enjoyed longevity and never once was asked to take a buyout or never laid off.
Well,
a miracle.
No, that's not a miracle. That only happens when they know they really need you, when you're really good.
The people
they never offer you
running.
Yeah. The people that they know keep the company running never get offered
a
package.
So when did you officially leave? Last spring?
April 1st, 2012. Yeah. So I'm a newbie at retirement. but we're settling in. I've had arrangements. I made a soft landing. Volunteer at the Henry Ford, so in transportation. So
at the museum.
At the museum, yep.
And that's how I met you, because I went to Bob Casey, the former transportation curator's retirement party, and got a chance to meet you. And one thing happened to another, and here you are on the set with us at After Hours.
I never thought I'd meet the man that I listen to every morning, Automotive Insights, get all that good stuff, and I don't know how you do it. You really get behind the scenes.
Well, thanks.
So what was the first engine program you worked on at Ford?
Well, I went in, let's see, we started the FE series for Ford Edsel and that whole string of
E400.
Big V8s.
Yeah, that were different block architecture, right? It was a brand new block architecture.
Oh, yeah, that was quite a change from the Y-block design, certainly. Mm-hmm. It was robust, and of course they had their sights on serving truck with that engine, too, so... they wanted to expand the truck heavy duty. So
is the FE what became the 390?
Oh, yes.
Okay.
Yeah, so 390.
So when did you sort of get sidetracked and start doing all the racing stuff?
Well, in 1957, I went away to work for Uncle Sam for 2 years, and I come back in 59. And at that time, the company was involved with... the early NASCAR USAC days, you know, and we were racing with the 406 cubic engine. And all the race engines were built there in the Triple E building in Dearborn, and the Holman or the Strop truck would come every Tuesday and bring some cores in and, and give them fresh ones, you know, and so on. Well, I was assembling the engine. I was selected to work on just the aisle there that did the race engines. And then later on become coordinator for signing off inspection sheets and getting material to dynamometer for keep that thing running and so on.
And then Ford, there was the dictate. Iacocca was at Ford, and the total performance era started, and you must have been right in the thick of that. That was the dawn before Shelby, but you were getting to NASCAR.
Versions of every Ford.
Yeah.
Performance Falcons. Performance Fairlanes, performance full-size Fords.
And I was in the thick of it, and I was very fortunate to be privileged to get closer and closer and finally entrusted to go to the track and work with the teams, you know, and help them whenever we can, because it was a yes, it was a special interest that we were going to excel in performance.
But you never built cheater engines, did you? Everything was absolutely to spec and to homologation requirement, right?
That's right. No, everything that came out of engineering was legal.
But after it went to the race team, sometimes would they fail?
Yeah, I would. Generally, when I had track duty, I'd end up at somebody's shop 3 or 4 days before, and we were on dyno 24 hours a day, you know. And then we sort of, yeah, the parts list changed a little bit at that time.
Mose, are you an engineer then?
Yes, only through experience.
You learned on the job.
I learned on the job. On the
so
job.
So you started as a machinist or what?
No, assembling experimental engines. This experimental engine department was working 5 years in advance of production. And that's where we would build 3 series of engines. The first series was all hand machine parts. Second series was a mixture of the handmade parts and some suppliers and our own in-house suppliers like our foundries and our machine lines.
But still sort of prototypes at that stage.
Still prototype. And then the third series engine was the one that would be introduced to the production plant. And that was all a combination of the frozen design of vendor parts and in-house components.
So when did you first start working on the 260, and which became the 289 and the Cobra engines and all that?
It was right after I came back from service that the small block was, it was dubbed the code name Can-X, Canadian X, and it was a small block V8 at 221 cubic inches, right. And it, you know.
The first thin wall casting V8 block, right?
Yes.
That had to be. Were they concerned about durability and stuff when they started the program?
Yes, we were, and there was a need to be, because you know you put an engine on dynamometer, and the dyno will break it quicker than in the car. No matter how hard you beat it in a car, the dyno, the rigid mounting, and the sustained speed, you know. And, it'll tell you where the weak points
so
are.
You turned the small block Ford into a racing V8, didn't you?
Yes.
That's awesome.
Yeah. Yeah, the 289 Hypo was the epitome of that. And then, in fact, that's what basically with the different induction went into the original Ford GT40s.
Mm-hmm. Were you involved in that program, the GT40?
No, I was not. But our friend Hank Lennox was.
Uh-huh. Yeah, we had been talking about Hank Lennox.
Working with John Wire and feeding them engines and parts and tech assistance and so on.
Were you involved in the Cobra with Shelby?
No, not at all. No. Shipping engines out there, and then they would tear them down and build them the way they wanted them.
Yeah.
So.
But you gave us some pictures of GT40s.
Mm-hmm.
So you went to Le Mans.
Yes. Yes, I went 2 years.
Well, let's.
I was only supposed to go 1 year.
Right?
Mark IIs and Mark IVs, if he was there 2 years. The Mark IVs only ran 1 year.
Yeah.
67.
Okay. Yeah.
Right.
But I think, Ben, let's see. We've got some pictures of a GT40, I thought, there. Maybe you could tell us about that. No, that's,
Mark, that's a Mark IV.
That's Mark IV, right.
That's a Mark IV.
That's the winning Mark IV.
Yeah.
No, that was
GT40.
There's
not
a GT4. Huh?
That's a Mark II.
Yeah.
See, it has a larger scoop in the sail panel.
Oh, yes. You're right.
Yeah, that's a 427 car.
Uh-huh. That's a 427 four-barrel, single four-barrel on that car.
And here's the car as it was in the day at Le Mans. And then, Ben, I think there's a restored picture of that.
Yeah.
So
yes.
What's the story behind now this?
That car, Ford kept it and did a few auto shows and things like that. But it was painted black to make it look like the number two winner. It was painted black with the number two on because the demand for the car at auto shows and different events was so great they couldn't handle them all. So they took that car and sprayed it black and put a two on it. And then in 1969, we gave it to the Indianapolis Museum. And it sat down there with a drip pan under it because it had a blown engine in it. And the engine during the transporting it around to the auto shows, maybe somebody was having fun in the parking lot with it, but they put a rod through the oil pan, a hole about like that, you know, and so on. And it sat in the museum with a drip pan under it, and It was in 2006, Tony George says, let's see if we can get that thing running. And they didn't know really where to start out. So they contacted technical affairs at Ford, and they tracked me down. And we started out with just going to rebuild the engine, you know. But the car had deteriorated so badly because you have a combination of aluminum and steel together, and that never works.
Galvanic reaction.
Yeah, galvanic reaction. And the rubber parts were done, and the brake lines were corroded shut and so on. So we cut a deal with the museum that you furnished the material, and four of us
veterans,
crazy ones, you know, four of us will volunteer the time to restore it. And that was an emotional experience for me, because when my associates brought the car up from Indianapolis and called me out to the barn there to see what we had and so on, I recognized this car. It was one that I had actually tuned in 1966 at Le Mans, so it was emotional. And then the old adrenaline started flowing, and I never ran out of energy. And the car was finished in September of 2011, and the first Inn of St. John's,
the Concours
Elegance. Yeah. We finished it for that, and at that time, that evening, when Indianapolis had a couple other cars up here, we loaded that on the transporter to take it back. So it was a great experience, and I enjoyed every minute of it. I don't know what my wife thought of the deal, but
so you went to Le Mans '66 and '67.
True. Yeah.
And you've got John.
Yeah, I've got some great memorabilia that Don brought here, Mose brought here. That these look like some sort of press pit credentials.
They were pit credentials in '67. The original '66 was the armband that gave you authority to go over the wall, through the wall, over the wall.
Over
we were
wall.
Discussing earlier. There was no wall.
No, there was no pit wall. They just dumped right out there.
You're out there tuning, you know, and your backside's hanging out, and here they go at 190 mile an hour, just a couple feet from you.
And this was just a red armband that says Le Mans 1966 in French, mechanic.
Mm-hmm.
And it's got some sort of lead.
It's a seal, so it was legit.
Yeah, that was a seal, so the cut down the counterfeiting of armbands and so on, because there was only so many permitted per car. And that's how the
But I love just even holding these things. I mean, this is history right
here.
Well,
you know, I've never collected much in all my racing experiences. I've never collected, you know, people get autographs on matchboxes and stuff like that, but I was never one to bother the driver or an owner for stuff like that. So those three items there, and then I have a French flag, which I, in 1967, got overzealous at our victory, you know, and I climbed up on top of the garage area there, and they had flags for every participant, every country, you know, and I'm pulling down this French flag, and there's some young folks down there going, you know, like this, and I thought, uh-oh, I'm in trouble, but I started handling the flag very gingerly, folding it, put it in my shirt, and then climbed out. So I've only got four items from any race. That's NASCAR, you know, NHRA, Le Mans, Indy. That's
so. Which Mark IV did you work on in '67 when you were there?
Well, actually, I went and tuned all of the Shelby Holman.
Okay.
I was the engine man. I took care of leak down tests at night and setting the timing and
the red car, the yellow car, and the black car, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And that was fabulous, because the French press said a Gurney and Foyt, that was a joke.
Yes, these guys don't know how to drive endurance racing.
Americans, right?
Yeah. Well, especially Foyt.
Foyt. And here's the guy that's stock cars and Indy cars.
Yeah, and they just poo-pooed it and ran
Here's a story I had heard. Maybe you know this, Mose, and could verify it. But I heard that Gurney was worried about the exact same thing, that AJ wasn't going to be able to get the car 24 hours through.
Yes.
And he knew there was some weak point, I want to say, in the drivetrain, not the engine,
gearbox.
But the gearbox. and that he told AJ, going through the chicane and this sort of stuff, you got to back off to this RPM, you got to drive it much slower and then get back on it. And that, so the story it was told to me, that AJ said, there's no way, we're going to lose way too much time if we drive it the way that you're talking. And Gurney was like, yeah, but this is the only way the car is going to finish. And then supposedly AJ went out, followed Gurney's advice, mm-hmm. and found that they didn't lose all that much lap time.
No.
And that's what made the whole car get through the 24 hours.
For AJ Foyt, he picked up time with that method.
Yeah.
But the shift mechanism was a little crude. It would hang up, but at the right speed, it was smooth right out.
So it's a true story.
Well, there was another famous story: is the Ferrari team was shadowing the number one Mark IV because everyone assumed the number one car with Gurney and Foyt was the Rabbit.
Right.
To go out and
it was going to run fast and it would break or they would screw up because the Americans couldn't drive.
So I forget who the driver was in the Ferrari, the P4, but they were shadowing Gurney. And Gurney just got, he said, what is with these guys? So he pulled off at the, I think at the hairpin. At the end of the Mulsanne.
Yeah, it was Mulsanne turn.
Turn, and he pulled off.
Yes, on the inside.
And the Ferrari pulled off,
behind
too.
Him.
And they sat there in the middle of the night. And, it's a true story.
Yeah.
I mean, Gurney's related this many times, right?
It is a true story.
The Ferrari team said, you do
follow
whatever Gurney does, or that car.
And remember who was running the Ferrari team then, too. It was Enzo, who was there.
Yes. And I just thought that was a phenomenal story. And then finally, Gurney said, this is ridiculous. He fired up and went back out, and they went out and won the race.
Yeah.
The Mark IV only ran two races, Sebring and Le Mans. They won both.
That's
never
true.
Ran again.
That is true.
That's right.
Yeah.
God, that's got to be one of the most famous race cars of all time that only ran two.
The car was functionally banned for the 68 season. That was the thing. They couldn't, even if they had wanted to, they would end up having to run probably Mark IIs, or they'd do what Wire did with the Mirage.
Well, they went to the smaller engines.
Right.
Yeah, well, that was the works of Enzo. He went in there. The only way he could hang with them was to not participate. Yeah.
Hey, we've got a lineup of the Le Mans start of the 67 race.
A real Le Mans start.
A real Le Mans start. But here's my question.
Yeah, that's the factory team.
Uh-huh.
But is that parked by qualification? Because if so, that would indicate the Mark IVs did not qualify well.
No, it's parked by garages, the garage allocation.
Garage.
The garage is set before they qualify.
Yeah.
So you see, that's the garage for car number 1, 2, Ford number 3.
So the
lineup, that's what makes the Le Mans start when you used to do it so terrifying.
Yeah.
Because sometimes at the short end, you have some very slow cars pulling
right.
up.
But you can see them.
I never knew that. They were lined up by garage, not by qualification.
Right. You can see by the signage that we're in front of our garage.
And those are,
I never knew
and
that.
And you see the four Mark IVs there.
Right.
1, 2,
yep.
3, and 4.
Yep.
And the others are Mark IIs.
Mm-hmm.
Very interesting.
But really an interesting time in my career.
Of all your career, of all the racing and engines, what's your favorite out of it all? What's your fondest memory?
That's kind of a tough one because I really enjoy the Indy. But anyway,
what stock
I have to say the Le Mans deal was probably it.
That's then, historic.
But, we haven't mentioned a racing series that Ford dominated for a year with amazing cars that was the closest thing to a car you could buy.
Yeah.
Trans Am.
Yeah, did you work on the
Trans Am? Did you work on the Trans Am?
I worked with Bud Moore on Trans Am, Parnelli Jones, certainly.
We ran against them, but Bud Moore was a real character.
There's the story of
Bud. I love that man.
Bud was a World War II hero.
Oh, superhero.
Yeah, I mean, this guy was just an
very
amazing.
Very decorated.
And boy, those guys, he had Parnelli Jones and George Fulmer.
Fulmer, right. Uh-huh.
And, there were team orders. It was a joke because I remember we were at Mid-Ohio and Parnelli and George beat on each other all the way around the track. I mean, for the last 20 laps or something. Yeah. And then I think they knocked each other off the track. And,
69.
70.
Okay, 70.
Yeah. Well, they were the only two out front, so they were picking on each other. But I thought it was great that Ford hung with Bud Moore and sponsored him for 70, when they'd shut down all the rest of them.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But, those were great days.
Yeah, did you work on the Indy engine at all?
Oh, yes. Yeah, I was on the original pushrod engine, assembled that, and then followed it to Kingman, Arizona for testing, dynamometer and so on, and tire tests at, in December at Indy.
In December at Indy?
Yeah, now how can you get a tire to stick when there's snowflakes on the track?
And how's the data going to be relevant in May?
Yeah, right, exactly. I couldn't figure it out, but anyway, we had to be there, and we were there, and so on. But it was engine usage, too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We've got a great picture that you gave us, too, Ben, of that Roadster versus the rear-engine car.
Yes.
Yeah.
I love that shot because you got a front engine, old style roadster.
There they are. Dinosaur.
So you were at Indy with Gurney, right?
Yes.
He was driving.
I was there in 1963 with the pushrod version. That was only a 1-year deal.
Right.
And then by that time, our engine had come off the design board and was
the fork.
We come home from Indy in 63, and I started assembling on the 64 engine. And then I made a couple races. I went to the Milwaukee Mile for that victory, so that was neat.
That's really cool. So you got to meet Jim Clark and hang out with Dan.
Colin Chapman, fine gentleman.
Yeah, we got a picture of Jimmy Clark up here.
Yeah, yeah.
So what was your favorite stock car race? Or you hung out with some of the... Did you ever meet Smokey Unick?
Yes, I have.
Yeah,
I met Smokey Unick, but I'm very loyal to our legends. You know, we had Junior Johnson, Ned Jarrett, you know. Of course, Andretti was with us for a while, Freddie Lorenzen, on and on and on. It was...
What was your favorite stock car race?
Probably the Charlotte 600 because it was the big test of the year, you know, 600 miles.
Yeah.
Yeah. But
that's great.
Yeah, a lot of great stories. I love telling
Smokey,
them.
You
some
know,
of them I can't tell, but
yeah, Smokey had sort of a GM allegiance, but he was off in his own solar system. So
yes, he was.
Planet Smokey was not where anyone else lived.
Yeah. Well, Junior was a little bit that way too.
Oh, yeah.
You know, he showed up at a track for practice with a very weird engine, and it blew apart. And, of course, they're scrambling out there to collect these pieces and so on, you know. And
because they didn't want anybody else to collect them.
And the tech boys in the garage come around, the NASCAR tech, you know, and said something. And Junior looked over and says, "You better talk to your maintenance boys. Looks like they blew up a lawnmower because there were needle bearings all over the place." Yeah, that was a quick hush thing.
Tech inspections have always been fascinating in serious big time motor racing, because there's a story of, and it was a Boss 302 story in Trans Am, of an inline carburetor that appeared at one race, and John Tamanis apparently opens up the hood in the car. And I think it was Bud Moore's car.
I believe.
Opens up the hood, and the story has it he went no. Because you could use, for 69, you could use 2 4 barrels.
Mm-hmm.
And after that, they said no multiple carburation for 70, right? And so they didn't, it was an inline 8-barrel carburetor, is the story I've heard.
Yeah.
And it's one carburetor.
Do you have something to do with that, Mom?
Yeah, we had a very innovative engineer that worked for the hardware and accessories group, which was responsible for electrical components and carburetors when we were breaking away sort of from the Hollywood. And Tom Johnson, he was a sharp fella. He come up with that, and he had it. They were hand-built out at Rawsonville. Yeah.
And then NHRA, you've been involved in drag racing.
Yes, I have in the early days. In fact, it all started with NHRA and Connie Coletta when we built the single over cam, and then NASCAR banned it. So we've got these engines. What do you do with them?
So that's how the single overhead cam engines ended up. I never figured out how they got into drag racing, because I always thought of it as a NASCAR engine.
Well, it was slated for NASCAR, but we got down to Daytona with them, and they said, no, sir. And
so it didn't even race in NASCAR?
No, did not race.
Oh, my gosh.
So then we've got these engines, and Connie Coletta and the Bounty Hunter got word of it, you know, and was going to try one. So he was the first one to break 250 mile an hour with that.
What was the motor you put in the Thunderbolts?
The Thunderbolt was
427.
It was a 427 single overhead cam.
Okay.
Because I made a few trips to a few garages. The time the cams was very complicated, and you had to have special tooling. And so I had my little satchel that I used to run around on Thursdays before they left for the track and time their cams, you know, and so on. And then after, a few times like that, and then I got some of these special tools to them, and they took off on their own. So, yeah.
A single overhead cam 427, which is, there's a lot of deck height to that engine. Did they build the car around the engine? I don't know how you'd get it in.
Well, I'll tell you, the front fenders went on last. That thing was so wide, and then if you put a competition exhaust system on it, it just stretched it wider, you know, and mm-hmm. and it was complicated to set down between the shock towers.
That's a car based off a Falcon. A first-generation Falcon.
Yeah, true.
Should we take some questions?
Yeah, we should, but I got one more question.
Yes.
57 years is an amazing career. What's the main differences you see today versus back when?
Well, I think it had a lot to do with what I was involved in, John. I think if anybody else had the same opportunity that I'd had, they would probably not look at the calendar ever again, you know, like that. And that's what happened to me. Never looked at the clock or the calendar, you know.
So you went to work and suddenly realized you'd been there 57 years?
Yeah. You know, people say, how do you do it? And, it's real easy, you know. You wake up, get up, dress up, and show up. And you just do this and do this. Because I was anxious to get there in the morning. The challenges were great. And I was generally given a lot of freedom to do what we had to do. And I don't know, 57 years slipped by.
No kidding.
Pretty fast.
Wow,
you know?
That's fantastic.
Yeah.
Hey, yeah, let's get to some of our viewer questions right now. So, Ben, let's run rapid fire. Okay, VRM Chris has a question, but Peter, I'm going to actually throw this to you, though. Mose, you can chime in, and Jim can, too. Yeah. Would a Trans Am series based on production Camaro, Mustang, and Challenger work?
I think it would, but you would have to get with Grand Am, which has now bought the LMS, and say, look, can we eliminate some of these other classes, split them off, and have a true production-based series? Grand Am has sort of something like that with their Continental. But it would be fun.
The problem is you've got an intrinsic architectural problem with one of the cars in there, and that's that the Challenger is so big and so heavy because it's based off of a much larger car that you'd have to have some way to equalize that out.
Yeah,
that would look equitable.
It would only work if the manufacturers got together in the back room, hopefully with much cigar smoke, and said, you know what, boys and girls, we're going to do this, so let's do it, let's promote it, let's support it. Otherwise, you'll never see it happen.
The replacement for the Challenger is at least a half-foot shorter in wheelbase and much lighter, so maybe next go-around.
Maybe. Interesting idea.
That'd be a great program to support our dealerships. They would love it.
A direct tie-in.
Yeah, a direct tie-in, because in later years here, we kind of drifted away from...
Sprint Cup's going to be sort of more production-looking.
Right.
NASCAR's taking credit for that, but it was the manufacturers who said, you either do this or we're going to get out. Mm-hmm. But NASCAR in the media tour this week said, we're so thrilled that we did this.
But I'm sorry, how do you make a front-wheel drive Fusion that now has a longitudinal V8 look like a real front-wheel drive Fusion?
Well, that story changed.
I know.
Right. Okay, Goggles Pisano wants to know, did Mose ever have anything to do with the Cosworth folks and the DFV engines?
No, I did not. The only thing I ever had involved with the Cosworth people was... We were very appreciative of their casting process. They had a unique process they had developed, and it turned out some pretty good aluminum for high-performance engines. But no, I was not part of that engine at all. I knew it was out there. I knew the history on it. But that
whole DFV program in some ways was almost like a marketing program more than a true engineering program, wasn't it?
I would.
Worked on the 429, didn't you?
Yes.
Which 429? The good, the semi-hemi? My favorite Ford engine of all time, the Boss 302 engine. I don't care about that.
Oh.
The Boss 302 engine to me was just an, or Boss 429 engine was just such an amazing.
You had to shoehorn that thing in.
Yeah.
In the
but, and it's still a great engine today for the aftermarket. Yeah. I know our Ford Performance Parts has moved a lot of iron.
Okay, Rum and Coke says, please get Mose to tell the story about how he saved Le Mans for Ford in 1967.
Well, I didn't think of it as that great of a feat, but we did have a car that the driver pulled in, and he said that I'm losing RPM. And what had happened was as I approached the car sitting there idling and him gunning it, I could hear lifter noise. And with a screwdriver and to the ear, the old-fashioned way, I located about where it was at and pulled the cover off. And this whole thing only took about 7 minutes, and he was back in. But what had happened one time during a dynamometer testing, one of the adjusting screws had backed off in the rocker arm. Now, they had a square root thread that was a self-locking deal. One time, we had one back off, and I never forgot it. And our vendor for that part was in once a week, you know. And I said to Ray, I said, you know what? Do me a favor and double CAD plate a handful of these screws. And I had that screw, which was had increased torque on it, and I whipped out the one that had lost its torque and put it the replacement in there, and off we went.
And you just happened to have one of those screws in your pocket?
Yeah, it was close by. Well, you know, you're there, they're dependent on you, and you think of all the what-ifs, and I just...
So it's not just show up, it's show up with the right stuff in your pockets.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, that's one of the things
about... But experience gets you there. Yeah, I mean, yeah. I'm telling you, you got to have a lot of duct tape, and you got to have a lot of foresight. And
when you go to Le Mans as an American team, you have to think about all of that stuff to bring
with you. Absolutely. And when you got the boss standing there for 24 hours watching his car, you better perform and have the right answers, I'll tell you.
That's a great story. That is really, and that's talk about planning and thinking ahead.
Well,
here's this one time it happened on the dyno. I better just have a handful of these things. That's really cool. Okay, Goggles, Peter says, which of these Corvettes of yours would you send to Le Mans or Daytona? Or would you send all three?
No, I'd send the Chaparral, of course.
Just that.
Yeah.
And how would you keep the Corvette brand from stepping on Cadillac's toes in the luxury market if they chased after Porsche?
Well, it's a, you know, clear sporting intention and one brand. And Cadillac, well, the difference is Corvette would be high-performance luxury. Cadillac would be luxury high-performance.
Plus, Cadillac, you know, if you think about the natural Cadillac product range, there's not a sports car like that in there. There could be a sporting car, a Boulevardier like an SL. It's a different kind of car.
Yeah. And, you know, they're about to do their new Ultimate sedan, and that's going to be a luxury Uber car.
We need to talk.
Yeah, I know. If they don't screw it up.
A.M. Guerrero's got a number of good questions here. Let me go with one of them. And Mose, he says, do you think that engine regulations in racing should be revised in the future? For example, a Ford NASCAR with a racing version of the EcoBoost V6.
Well, I don't know if we're ready for that, but...
I don't think
that... I don't know how you'd class that.
I don't because think the fans are ready for that sound.
No.
Well, there's another thing, too. As soon as you start doing overhead cam turbocharging in engines, and especially with turbocharging, don't you sort of open up the door for a lot more optimization? I won't say cheating, but optimization that is much tougher with a normally aspirated engine.
You certainly do, but in today's racing world, you got to follow that up with computerized engine control systems.
Is that the biggest change in your career is the electronics?
Oh, yes, yes. That passed me up a long time ago.
Yeah. And fuel injection, I got to believe, too, is a big change.
Yeah.
Well, they're only getting
injection
now.
Well, that's NASCAR, right?
Yeah. And we fought for a long time for that because this restrictor plate business is...
My attitude on the, you know, instead of restrictor plates, first of all, pull about 25 rows of the stands out, go to a small displacement V8 with no restrictors.
No restrictions.
And so that the drivers actually have to lift off the throttle going into turn one. You know, when the drivers have to actually drive.
Mm-hmm.
That would change the complexity of the super speedway racing completely.
And I think it would do a great deal to making it safer,
yeah,
too.
Yeah,
man, and these guys are 4 inches off each other, bumper at 200 mile an hour, and packed up, you know, all 43 of them.
Well, in the last race, we saw the effect of that.
Yeah, terrible.
Yeah, I just don't want to see a driver lose his life because, you know, some foresight could have been used.
Well, I don't even like this idea of, well, we're just waiting for the big one. Hey, yeah. They're going to Talladega. That's there's going to be the big one.
Yep. The drivers don't even like
that.
No.
I mean, so, you know, go to a small displacement VA, like a 3-liter V8 or 2.5 liter, whatever.
And make them race.
Yeah, no
make
restrictors and just drive around and see what happens. But guess what? They'd have to drive.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Jim, I'm going to throw this one at you. David Malinowski says, hey, guys, I'm not seeing any new Fusions on the road here in upstate New York. Any idea why?
Well, they're out there.
They're out there, but it's see, we see an artificial number of them in Detroit.
Correct.
As you go around the country, you do not see as many of them. And there, I was in another state, and they were kind of rare, few on the ground, and, you know, it's like, it's... And I don't think it's the appeal of the car. I think it's just distribution of the car and getting the right stuff out that people want to buy.
Well, yeah, it's taken longer to ramp them up. If I was CEO of GM, the first thing I would do is I would tell everyone we're going to Austin, Texas for 6 weeks. Why? Because we're going to go to a place where the automotive news, if it's even in the newspaper, is buried in the end of the business section.
Or in the front of the classifieds.
Yeah, and we need to hang out in an environment that... you know, isn't so car-centric. I mean, in this town, an executive change is on the front page.
The rest of the world, they don't even know that there is an executive running most of these companies.
And I'd hang out at the dealers, mm-hmm. you know, be there when people come into the write-up and see what's going on, and then come back and say, what do we learn?
If this industry was a city somewhere in northern Georgia, they'd all be hemophiliacs.
How did you come up with that one?
Yeah. My question, too, Mose.
They're all in there, Mose.
Yeah. Okay, RMT1 wants to know, Mr. Nolan, what do you think of Ford's EcoBoost engine line?
Well, I think it's great, you know, and I applaud our company for reaching out to over the edge a little bit with downsizing the engine, taking the weight out of it, and yet surpassing horsepower.
Yeah, good power.
I do.
You know... that was, everyone laughed when Ford said, well, we're going to put the EcoBoost in the F-150.
That is a sweet powertrain. It mm-hmm. really is. And I was as skeptical as anybody else, but the first one I got in, put it in, they had the tip-in calibration a little wrong at first, and they just lit up the rear wheels and like, whoa, not what I expected. But it really is. It's a very...
It's the take rate. Isn't the take rate approaching 50%?
That's all V6s. It's not just EcoBoost. And the thing is that they're normally aspirated V6s doing very, very well in the F-150. It's ahead of what they expected to.
Yeah. I got to drive an early mule, too, because same thing.
The big red one that was the extended cab? Yeah.
And I was very skeptical, and I got in and drove it and went, wow.
Were you grinning after about a mile?
Probably 100 yards.
Okay.
And I told them at the time, I said, you know, if you play around a little bit with the exhaust note, you could fool an awful lot of the public into believing it's just a V8. That's how well it worked.
Yeah.
And that's why it's selling so well. And what are they charging, like $1,800 a pop to get that EcoBoost engine?
Yeah, it sounds right.
Something like that. So, I mean, they're making good money on it. Let's see, what all do we have here? There's a lot of comments, more than questions, about your Corvette and, you know, love the concept of, you know, a base Stingray. People really love it. And, in fact, AAH guest 224 says, when should we see the Stingray in dealers? And well, I think he's talking about yours.
Yeah, I said 2016.
And I like your idea, but it's almost like I would want to have the design of the two cars a little bit hooked closer to the hip. I really would. When you launch the idea, then when you do the second generation of it, go ahead and be brave and then start to spread it apart. But at first, I really think you want to use the main car to sell the new one and then the new one to build a market for the other car. That, I mean, I like the sketch because it has a lot of the feel of the right and proper.
Maybe we tweak the C7 to be more like the
Okay, Scott V says, the current Corvette ZR1 recently obliterated the new SRT Viper in numerous publications, both on the track and on the dyno. Do you think this is the shape of things to come with the all-new Vet? Probably. The new one's going to be better.
Yeah, it's not going to get any slower. So, you know, yeah. I got to think that the vehicle that replaces the ZR1 is probably going to be a hellaciously fast car that'll be probably a more balanced car in a lot of ways than the Viper has been. Now, I haven't driven a new Viper. I want to. But I'm concerned that the Viper has a tendency to be deliberately raw. Because it's part of its character. I remember when it came out, there were people.
It was crude.
It was crude, and that was part of its appeal because it really was like a postmodern Cobra.
Right.
But now the whole game is so different, and I still think as much as I like the ZR1, it's not my favorite Corvette. My favorite Corvette is the Z06 because it is the most balanced. It is the driver's Corvette, and it's the closest thing to me to a pure Corvette that they've done in decades. This from a guy that once had a twin cam LT5 ZR1.
Scott V also wants to know, is this Viper versus ZR1 performance an indication that the SRT's efforts in ALMS will be futile in ever dethroning the Vet as champion?
Well, you know, the Viper team showed up at Mid-Ohio last July 4 seconds off the pace. And by October for Petit Le Mans, they were right on the pace, but they were given, let's say, dispensations in certain areas, so that they could, you know, have a representative showing. You know, I don't know.
Is any of the Aurica structure in the new Team Viper? It's not, is it?
No, the problem for Viper is, and, you know, don't get me wrong, I think Viper is very cool, but the problem is when they went to the V10 in the original, even though it's an aluminum now and all that, there are limitations with that V10 in terms of
the structural limitations, and you start deforming the engine as you rev it faster.
Well, it's weight and bulk over the, you know, front end. So, but, you know, Dodge couldn't very well put an all aluminum monster Hemi V8 in it because the Viper Prius would go nuts. But if the Viper Prius stood back a little and they said, now, wait a minute, if we do this V8 Viper, it's going to put your V10 Viper on the trailer. It would be interesting to see what the Viper enthusiasts thought about that.
I contend that the V10 and the Viper is so much a part of the product's DNA, it would be like not doing a flat six rear-engined 911.
No, I get it.
Yeah.
I get it. But if they want to win in 2014 with the new GT rules, they aren't going to.
Well, the new GT rules, yeah, make it really tough. That's true.
So that's going to be a difficult proposition for them.
Well, this is probably a good time, Bob, to wrap up.
Awesome. Real pleasure to have you on the show.
Well, thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here tonight because I never get tired of telling the stories.
Well, yeah. I mean, you were there. That's, you know.
This man has worked on some of my favorite cars of all time.
He's lived part of the history that, you know, I grew up reading about. Here's the guy who did it.
Yeah. Well, I've been blessed. It was a privilege to ride. It's been a great ride, I'll tell you, as they usually say.
And thanks for bringing in the credentials, the mechanics armband.
He does get those back, you know.
Yeah. Well, darn, I wish you had not said that.
The museum wants them.
Yeah. Jim Hall, great having you here as always.
A pleasure.
Always.
Thank you for inviting me. It was a great one. I had a great time.
Yeah. Peter, as always, man, as always. Sure. And I loved how you stirred up the pot on your ideas for what to do with Corvette.
Well, you know.
If you're not stirring up the pot,
something's wrong.
Everyone's going to think they got the issue licked and no need to change anything.
I don't doubt that the versions coming of the new Corvette will be sensational. And, you know, those guys and gals do a fabulous job. I just wish the design would be a little different, that's all.
Okay, folks, before we go, if you're traveling, remember, get the podcast at the iTunes store. Just look for it at Autoline After Hours. It's free and it's a great way to kill a plane ride. Anyway, we'll see you next week.
Autoline After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone. Your journey, our passion.
Visit our website, autoline.tv, where you can watch us live Thursday nights at 6 p.m. Eastern, Get your daily news fix with AutoLine Daily and in-depth analysis and interviews with AutoLine This Week. There's all that and much more at AutoLine.tv.